From inside and outside the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, this is Democracy Now!
And so, we disagree on a critical issue like welfare. But then, if we elect him, there is another day and a better day. But don't stop there. We are mature enough to differ without splitting. That's what makes democracy real. We must protect one big tent.
Jesse Jackson finally addresses the Democratic Convention and proves he's a team player. The Democratic Leadership Council, the right wing of the party forged by President Clinton, is calling the shots here at the convention. We'll tell you who's involved and what's the agenda. And Congresswoman Maxine Waters tells progressives that it's time for them to organize to take back their Democratic Party. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. We are broadcasting from right outside the convention center. I'm here with Larry Bensky and Salim Wakil. I'm Amy Goodman. And today, after 2 days of speeches, actors, and hoopla, Democrats are getting down to the business of nominating a presidential candidate tonight. Displaying well-orchestrated unity, Democrats will welcome President Clinton to Chicago with a traditional roll call of the states. It will mark the first time since 1936 that a sitting Democratic president has not faced a convention challenge from within his own party. Well, national affairs correspondent Larry Bensky, what did you think last night?
I thought a lot of things, Amy. I tried to focus on Hillary Rodham Clinton and bring my mental powers to bear on what image she might be projecting on the vast masses of the people in this country, or at least the tiny fringe of the black masses that are watching this. And it seemed to me that she got over okay. But what really shocked me is the fact that the things she said are being thought of as controversial. I mean, they are so mild, so cliched even. For example, when she said her famous lines, "To raise a happy, healthy, and hopeful child, it takes a family, it takes teachers, it takes clergy, it takes business people, it takes community leaders, it takes all of us, yes, it takes a village." Who's going to argue with that? What are we fighting about here?
I guess
here?
Bob Dole did.
What are we fighting?
Of the Republicans.
What are we fighting about here? I mean, what's the point of all this? You know, it takes as many positive influences on a child's life as one can bring to bear. That's all she seems to be saying.
Well, really, what it reveals is how vacant the Republican attack on this whole notion of a village is. I mean, the fact that she had to respond to it is also pretty strange, because there's really no reason to be so focused on that. I mean, it's obvious. It's a commonplace, really, and the Republicans have taken it to such a banal level that it seems that it lowers Hillary to respond to it.
And the thing is that, you know, what they should be talking about, and she should be talking about, is why don't we have a sense of community in the United States?
Yeah.
Why don't we have a village? What is necessary to make a village? What are the common values that are being torn apart by the economic individualism that is stressed from the time you're old enough to walk or think or go to school?
Which would have been an effective way to respond to the Republican charge,
You know, I think a lot of people were surprised by this attack, the Republican attack on the African proverb, it takes a village. I mean, really, as we said yesterday, and as President Clinton has actually said in the last week, Bob Dole himself exemplifies this. When he came back from World War II, he was seriously wounded, went to Russell, Kansas. The whole community was there for him. They raised money. They took care of him. And I think this is what Hillary Clinton had to respond to, the idea that she was, God forbid, a socialist, which is clearly what Bob Dole suggested. He said, when they say a village, they mean the state. And we are talking about the nuclear family. They're talking about it takes a man married to a woman with their two-point-whatever children. Well, let's see exactly how Hillary Clinton put it last night.
And we have learned that to raise a happy, healthy, and hopeful child, it takes a family. It takes teachers. It takes clergy. It takes business people. It takes community leaders. It takes those who protect our health and safety. It takes all of us. Yes, it takes a village.
Hillary Clinton last night in her much-awaited address to the Democratic Convention.
And her next line was, and yes, it takes a president. And of course, that received a huge ovation. And you know, Amy, I never stop wondering, and Salim, I never stop wondering at the absolute blandness, lack of memory, and lack of intelligence on the part of television commentators. I happened to be watching ABC at the time she was giving this, and immediately it was after they went to the cadaver of David Brinkley, who somehow or other manages to get propped up there year after year, for his insight. And Peter Jennings said to him, do you ever remember a president's wife or the wife of a presidential candidate getting up there and being such a strong advocate for her husband? And Brinkley said, not in my memory. Then they went to the floor to Sam Donaldson and said, Sam, do you remember? Not in my memory. I remember 2 weeks ago Elizabeth Dole doing this in San Diego.
Well, Larry, you have a very good memory.
I guess I do. Neither David Brinkley nor Sam Donaldson seem to be able to remember 2 weeks ago in San Diego Elizabeth Dole's speech on the floor.
Especially since other parts of the media were attempting to play up a contrast between Dole's presentation and Hillary's presentation. Of course, Hillary came out the loser in that contrast because the Oprah-like presentation that Dole's wife gave was really wowed the audience, wowed the journalists especially.
But what's this really all about, this whole Hillary fascination, this fascination with personality? It was interesting to me, channel flipping last night here in Chicago, watching what the channels were really interested in. At least as interested in Hillary Rodham Clinton and her speech, were they interested in the party being given by George Magazine, one of the hot book magazines of total superficiality that has been started by John F. Kennedy Jr. And they had the Art Institute of Chicago rented out for a party. There were 1,000 people outside waiting to watch the celebrities come inside. And they constantly cut away from the convention to do this. And I thought to myself, well, that's what it's really all about. The celebrity of Hillary Rodham Clinton, the celebrity of who can get their eyes first on whoever is going to march into this slick party. And Hillary Rodham Clinton being up there trying in some manner, inadequate in my mind, of course, she didn't even mention the whole W word, the welfare question, which is on many people's minds here, but not dealing with many issues, but still trying to make a serious presentation of the issues. Why is this woman so magnetic, so charismatic? She's actually hated and despised. If you listen to some of these right-wing talk shows or read the right-wing websites, this is a woman who murdered her ex-lover, Vincent Foster. This is a woman who stole hundreds of thousands of dollars in the state of Arkansas. This is a woman who's been responsible for conspiracies of various kinds that we can't even begin to mention here. We didn't have time.
And you're wondering why she didn't admit to any of this last night?
I don't know why she didn't cop to it and say, now, wait a minute, I did not kill Vincent Foster. Okay, let me just get that straight before everybody here in the convention center. But I think what it is, Amy, it really boils down to me to the fact that in this culture we have a lot of residual sexism. We have a lot of people who deeply resent the fact that this is a powerful and successful woman. Whatever corners she may have cut ethically, men cut those
corners
too.
As is Elizabeth Dole.
As is Elizabeth Dole. They both come from the same generation. Elizabeth Dole's a little older. They had to fight their way through all male milieus in the elite law schools that they went to. They changed their politics as weather vanes. Hillary Rodham Clinton started out as a Goldwater Republican. Elizabeth Dole as a Johnson Democrat. And then attached themselves to careerist men and attach their career to them.
And they both went in the other direction.
And they went in the opposite direction. And they're successful. They're successful. If you look at the number of people in this country, for example, who are following promise keepers now, who want to shove women back in the kitchen, who want to make sure that women don't have careers, who basically are confused, upset, and virulent about successful women in this country, then you see a lot of, I think, why Hillary Rodham Clinton is detested and despised by what is still, in many ways, an extremely sexist culture.
You know, I think a lot of progressive feminists are torn on the issue of Hillary Clinton because, on the one hand, seeing clearly that she is in a bind, as is Elizabeth Dole, not to step forward, not to suggest in any way there would be any partnership, as Bill Clinton and Hillary Dole suggested in 1992. She has stepped way back. But on the other hand, she is the epitome of a corporate lawyer, and that was clearly demonstrated in her whole push push for health care reform in this country. Now, it might surprise some that last night, basically, almost Hillary Clinton's whole speech was about health care. Some might think that she would have wanted people to forget about what happened. Now, as the media characterized it, they were trying to socialize medicine. But as many progressives, many people who were for universal health care felt, she had forgotten that from the beginning. So it might have surprised some people, and she had kept universal health care, the issue of single payer, out from the very beginning of attempting to change welfare health care in this country. So it might have surprised some to hear what she had to say last night.
But our experience was nothing like the emotional strain on parents when their children are seriously ill. They often worry about where they will get the money to pay the medical bills. That is why my husband has always felt that all American families should have affordable health insurance. Just last week, the president signed a bill sponsored by Senators Kennedy and Kassebaum, a Democrat and a Republican, that will enable 25 million Americans to keep their health insurance even when they switch jobs or lose a job or have a family member who's been sick. This bill contains some of the key provisions from the president's proposal for health care reform. It was an important step, achieved only after both parties agreed to build, not block, progress on making health care available to all Americans. Now the country must take the next step of helping unemployed Americans and their children keep health insurance for 6 months after losing their jobs.
And of course, it's very important to note that more and more people will be poor as a result of the welfare repeal bill. But going back in time to 1993, when Hillary Clinton was trying to attempt health care reform in this country, though many felt she was trying to ensure that the insurance companies maintained a role, this is when she first came to really hate the press. When she was on the health care speech circuit in Lincoln, Nebraska in 93, she referred to the bane of all people in political life, and add that is the unfair, unjust, inaccurate reporting that goes on from coast to coast, north to south, east to west. Unfortunately, they were not raising the issue that she was not raising single payer. They were talking about it the other way. And I'll always remember that picture in the New York Times back to that time. The first picture of the healthcare group that Hillary Clinton had surrounding her and Ira Magaziner, and they said, this is the think tank that is going to reshape healthcare in this country. Insurance execs, hospital execs, not one patient advocate, not one consumer activist.
And the problem here is, I think we see it clearly in the discourse last night, Hillary Clinton is talking to, about, and for the middle class. She's not talking about the people who are really most affected by the health care crisis in this country, and that is poor people. She's not talking about the 40 or 47 million people that don't have health insurance to transfer from one job to another, that aren't going to get it through any provisions that the president has advocated so far. She keeps talking to the middle class. What would happen to you if suddenly something happened to you? Those are the votes that they're looking for. When you see the people that Hillary Rodham Clinton addresses and talks about versus, for example, the people that Jesse Jackson speaks to and talks about, you're talking about two completely different worlds. The world that gets on primetime is the world that Hillary Rodham Clinton is addressing. The world that gets earlier time and doesn't get on primetime is Jesse Jackson's world. It was interesting to me, Amy, that one of the networks, I think it was ABC, did pull cuts from Jesse Jackson's speech and stick them in primetime, kind of to spite the Democrats and say, well, Jesse Jackson did speak here tonight and you guys stuck him in the earlier time, but we're going to pull him back on to primetime.
And to think this is revolutionary, the idea that the networks have opened up this window, what they're calling primetime, where they will air about an hour of the events. And mainly what they're doing is they're saying to the Democrats that in this hour, you can program for us. You decide who will speak. And it's rare that you have the pulling of cuts from earlier in the afternoon and earlier in the evening and putting them into primetime. Why not have run Jesse Jackson's whole speech in primetime? In fact, it actually would have served President Clinton very well. He could could have written the speech himself, not around poverty, but around the call for unity.
Yes, but, you know, Jesse made a point of mentioning the fact that his speech was in prime time, although it clearly wasn't. I think he was trying to show his followers that he's still being respected, although he was clearly being demoted a bit. And it was interesting to see him do that. You know, this is prime time, people.
Well, it's prime time for him compared to, you know, Both Sides Now with Jesse Jackson, which is usually his only exposure on television, his weekly CNN show.
So Jesse Jackson spoke last night around, I guess it was 7 o'clock here in Chicago, 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time.
And so we disagree on a critical issue like wildfire. But then, if we elect him, there's another day and a better day. But don't stop there. We are mature enough to differ without splitting. That's what makes democracy real. We must protect one big tent. One big tent, my brothers and my sisters. When the president stands for the end of assault weapons, raises minimum wage, earned income taxes, stands with the mourning congregations of burned churches, stands for affirmative action and voting rights and social justice and gender equality, he deserves 4 more years.
That's very important, folks. That line there, Jesse Jackson saying in a way he hasn't said in previous conventions, 4 more years, fully putting himself behind the Democratic candidate. Usually he's more cryptic, he's more removed. Last night, President Clinton couldn't have done it better himself, although I think that they were afraid, because if you notice, he was the only person who spoke yesterday who did not read from a teleprompter. He had his own speech. He was looking down the whole time. But in the end, they could have written it.
Well, it was a melding of symbols. I mean, the whole family values issue. He was introduced by his son, Jesse Jr., and who incidentally spoke in Spanish during the introduction to kind of make this coalition push that Jesse is beginning to push a lot more since he's moving away from Minister Louis Farrakhan's orbit. It melded all of the images, and Jesse did speak effectively to the certain issues of poverty and the gap between those who were being imprisoned. He spoke of the convention center and the Sox Field as being two mountains, being
with a canyon in between.
With a canyon in between, and that canyon no one else spoke to.
That's right. He named names of corporations that had left.
But you know something. A few years ago, right after the uprisings in Los Angeles around the Rodney King trial and verdict, I went to that part of Los Angeles. I was in Los Angeles, and I was speaking to a crowd of young people who had gathered around at a community center. And Jesse Jackson had taken a strong anti-violence point at that point, and I asked them about that. I don't know if they were gaming me or what, but 3/4 of them told me that they hadn't heard of Jesse Jackson. They didn't know who he was. And it seemed to me they were telling me the truth.
Yes, indeed. Jesse was never really well thought of in the inner cities of this country. In fact, when he first ran, he embraced Louis Farrakhan as a way to gain sort of black authenticity. So, and that's really what helped him to gain that authenticity. But since of late, and he came up, he jumped on the Million Man March bandwagon pretty late as well. So he's been eclipsed in terms of his grassroots leadership by much more nationalistic figures like Farrakhan.
What about here in Chicago? We have a march that's going to happen later today, led by the Reverend Al Sharpton. You think Jesse Jackson will be on it?
I think he's lending support. I've heard him talk about lending support for it, but he's keeping hands off. He doesn't want to be personally involved.
You know, Salim, you mentioned Jesse Jackson Jr., the congressman from here in Chicago, and he is, of course, Jesse Jackson's son, introducing Jesse Jackson. Well, after his speech, I bumped into Jesse Jackson because we were on TV Row, and that's where all of these speakers go afterwards. And one of the reporters said to Jesse Jackson, is it true that last week there was a conference call of black leaders and your son, Jesse Jackson Jr., when they were talking about having a protest on the Democratic convention floor, he said no. In the end, though he has fiercely criticized welfare appeal, he was the one to say, we cannot do that.
Yes, they look at Gingrich, and in fact, Jesse evoked the names, Gingrich, Buchanan, and who was the
mixing
other?
Mixing them in there with Nazi war criminals.
Ralph Reed, right, that troika. I mean, that troika strikes fear in the hearts of progressives and black folks around the country, and they think that this The demonizing of this opposition is enough to force unity and to squash all dissent.
The way that Jesse Jackson puts it is that the Republican convention had bookends of Colin Powell and Jack Kemp, but look what was inside the book. Pat Buchanan, Ralph Reed, and Newt Gingrich.
Well, I should say also that people were not afraid to talk about pro-choice issues. Kate Michaelman spoke earlier in the day, the National Abortion Rights Action League. And while tonight senators will be speaking, women senators, yesterday you also had Cynthia McKinney speaking, and she talked about pro-choice. After that, we're going to go to a break and hear from Harvey Gantt, as well as Victor Morales of Texas.
But I must remind you that extremist forces in control of the Republican Party are arrayed against choice in America. Their first goal is control of the White House. Next is control of our bodies. We must remember that the genuine goal of the anti-choice forces is control. Control over women's lives. As a mother myself, I believe that abortion in America should be legal, safe, and rare.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. And speaking of grassroots, in just a little while, we're going to be hearing from people outside the convention. In fact, last night, 1,000 people marched in the convention. They prevented delegate buses from coming through, so there was every taxi in the city bringing delegates. Inside the convention, though, there were some people that not a lot of people saw if they were watching primetime, certainly not their whole three-minute speeches. And we're going to go to those speeches now. We're going to hear from Victor Morales, who is a candidate for Senate from Texas, beat the man who was being supported by the Democratic machine, Congressman John Bryant, surprised a lot. A Chicano school teacher from Texas, his kids, his students challenged him to run. And then we're going to hear from Harvey Gantt, who is challenging Jesse Helms in North Carolina. Victor Morales speaking yesterday, a speech you might not have heard if you were watching the networks last night.
Is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. Therefore, do not send to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. I have repeated that quotation across the state of Texas because it describes how many of us in the Democrat Party feel. We know how important our families are. We don't need someone to tell us what it feels like when our sons and daughters hug our neck and say, I love you, Daddy, or when a spouse is next to us in hard times. But we also know how important the community is, that a family alone does not build the road or build the school. It takes all of us. And that is why it is so vital that we elect a president who is working to strengthen both our families and our communities. You know, we hear a lot of talk about values, and sometimes we do differ between parties. For example, we're all familiar with my opponent's statement. His statement was, I have the best friend a politician can have, ready money. But that's not the way we think. No. We feel that much more important than big money are things like las ganas, desire, el corazón, the heart, y lo más importante, and the most important, la gente, the people. There was never any question in my mind that we could win. The only question was by how much. And now, here I stand before you, a classroom teacher of 18 years that could have been a nurse, construction worker, a small business person, straight from the people. I am you. And I thank God for the strength for my mom, for my wife, and my children. And I also want to thank very much the public school education and all the teachers that put in the weekends and the nights. It is through your help that I have arrived this far. And this is why it's so important that Bill Clinton's administration return to the White House to continue their work in preserving Pell Grants, bilingual education, Head Start, and AmeriCorps. And for those who question still the right of an everyday working person to be a United States Senator, I say to you, ¿y por qué no? And why not? Who better to understand the realities of everyday life but one of us? And President Clinton understands that. Now, so often our everyday struggles are likened to David and Goliath. Well, listen for a second. As Goliath approached, David ran out to him and, reaching into his shepherd's bag, took out a stone, hurled it from his sling, and hit the Philistine in the forehead. Phil Graham, we are ready.
Victor Morales, candidate running against Phil Graham in Texas. It's really interesting to think that if Victor Morales was elected, I've just been sitting here trying to think, he would be only the second person that I can think of, the other being Paul Wellstone, to have been elected to the U.S. Senate, who does not come out of a legislative or or legal background. He's not a legislator in Texas. He's not a member of Congress. He's not a lawyer. He's actually a working person. Paul Wellstone, I guess college professor, counts as work. That's what he was doing before that, too.
You know, we should say that, let's not forget, he's going up against Phil Graham, a man who has some of the deepest pockets in this country. And you have Victor Morales, who drives around Texas in his pickup truck. I remember seeing Inside Politics on CNN comparing their amount of money. I think they had said he spent something like $20,000, and they said, Phil Graham, it was in the millions.
Two, three million.
Right, when I was sitting in the Texas delegation as he was about to speak, a lot of the people there, especially Mexican Americans who were delegates from Texas, were extremely proud. And they said that the polls had actually closed to something like 12% between he and Phil Graham. So there is a significant race going on, so much so that Phil Graham is sending out letters, well, he does this always to raise money, saying he is in a very hotly contested race. He does this, of course, to raise money, as Newt Gingrich has said in Georgia.
Well, somebody else who's in a hotly contested race is Harvey Gantt, and he also spoke last night. The networks didn't carry it. Here's a little of it on Pacifica.
Ladies and gentlemen, fellow Americans, I want to begin by telling you that in North Carolina, I will defeat Jesse Helms this November. I'm an architect, and I'm a Democrat, which means that I'm a builder. We don't believe in tearing people down. We believe in building the future. These days, families are facing a whole new world of challenges, and we need to find whole new ways to help them reach the American dream. That's something that I know a little bit about. My parents didn't have much money and precious little formal education, but they were rich in the values and the promises of what this country could mean. They taught their five children that with hard work and perseverance, with faith in God and personal responsibility, anything was possible in this country. And I watched our family move from poor to middle class, from parents with little education to children with college degrees, from public housing to home ownership. As a child, I held the 2x4s for my daddy as he built our first home with his own hands.
An excerpt of the speech of Harvey Gantt, who is the Democratic candidate for Senate in North Carolina. He's running against Jesse Helms, and certainly in the next few weeks we'll be bringing you a lot more on that North Carolina race. You're listening to Democracy Now. We'll be back in 30 seconds. Coming up in our next hour, we'll be talking to author Samuel Friedman about several generations of three American families he followed who moved from Roosevelt to Reagan and beyond. We'll also be looking at the corporate parties that are going on here at the Democratic Convention, a drug company sponsoring Democratic women yesterday, and a visit to the convention floor with Michael Moore, yes, of Roger and Me. Stay with us. And you are tuned to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with our national affairs correspondent Larry Bensky and Salim Wakil. Joining us in a minute is Bruce Shapiro of The Nation magazine. But first, we wanted to bring you an excerpt of the keynote speech of the so-called New Democrat, the Indiana Governor, Evan Bayh.
President Clinton is meeting the challenge of improving our schools, and he starts with the basics, the values and discipline that bring students to the classroom and bring them ready to learn. Tougher truancy laws, more drug prevention, school uniforms, higher standards so a diploma will mean something. In this election, no issue more clearly defines the differences between the two major parties and our nominees than education. On that issue alone, President Clinton and Democrats who share his vision deserve the support of the American people.
Evan Bayh, the governor of Indiana, giving the keynote address last night, the poster child for the New Democrats, I think it's really very fair to say. And we're going to spend this next segment talking about the Democratic Leadership Council. You may have heard about it, you may not have. Every day in the list of convention activities is a morning Democratic Leadership Council summer school for New Democrats. Joining us to talk about the DLC, its power now, and the shift to the right of the Democratic Party is Bruce Shapiro, who's doing a piece on this for The Nation magazine. Welcome, Bruce.
Good morning.
And has been having a lot of fun in summer school, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. It's just like going to camp.
What are they teaching there?
They're trying, well, maybe we should start with basics. You know, the Democratic Leadership Council is really a caucus of conservative Democrats, which produced new Democrats like Evan Bayh, like Al Gore, like Bill Clinton. In fact, started out in 1985 as a coalition of mostly Southern moderate to conservative Democrats hoping to win Reagan Democratic voters back. So in summer school here at the Democratic Convention, they've been trying to drill sympathetic delegates in talking points, in how to spin issues like public schools, healthcare policy, Social Security in a moderate to conservative way and to fight the liberal wing of the Democratic Party.
Back up a second and tell us what economic interests are behind this Democratic Leadership Conference. I assume it is not a philosophical and philanthropical organization that exists solely for the debate of ideas.
Scarcely. In fact, it really started out more as a strategy than a set of ideas even. It really was a sort of an attempt to forge a Southern strategy. And that kind of didn't work out, but at the same time, which is for interesting reasons and perhaps we can talk about, but at the same time as these generally conservative ideas were being floated up, the economy started to globalize and corporations discovered that it was in their interest to have a voice within the Democratic Party in favor of free trade, in favor of NAFTA, in favor of GATT, And so large corporations like AT&T and Bell Atlantic and so on, as well as a large number of Silicon Valley and computer industry companies like Microsoft and their officers, have become immense supporters of the DLC, which really has at this point not a lot of foot soldiers, but lots of money.
Now, President Clinton was chair of the DLC, is that right, as he was governor of Arkansas?
He was one of the founding chairs, one of the founding members of it, and was one of the very first chairs.
Tell us about the vote that took place in the early 1990s on the kind of the platform of the DLC that didn't just include our standard idea of delegates, but actually corporations voted on this platform.
That's right. The DLC invited its advisory board of corporations to vote on a platform that included not just even a kind of generic rightward spin, but very specific calls for deregulating international environmental standards. They called in particular for strengthening trade with China at a time when there were human rights groups and others were calling on this country to limit trade. It's an unusual group in that it's really overt in its support for corporations. The current DLC chair, Joe Lieberman, is fond of saying
Senator of Connecticut.
Yes, is fond of saying that you have to support business if you're going to support the United States.
Bruce Shapiro, how does the Progressive Policy Institute relate to the DLC?
The Progressive Policy Institute is simply the DLC's think tank. They share an office. They share officers. Sometimes there's a bit of a fight between the head of the DLC, whose name is Al Fromm, and the head of the Progressive Policy Institute, whose name is Will Marshall, as to who's going to get in the press. But beyond that, it's the policies and ideas that the DLC articulates and that these new Democrat politicians like Dole articulate come out of the Progressive Policy Institute. And they range from, they're important ideas, you know, they range from free trade ideas, freeing up investment, which is really the central idea of the whole thing. It's really about Wall Street, to school reform based on strong management on the William Daley Chicago model, for example.
What about telecommunications? That, to me, is where all of this really comes to a head, the deregulation, the unleashing of corporate interests, the complete screwing of the average citizen because the corporations get to do what they absolutely want. Al Gore backed down totally on his principles of this when he took office. What role did the DLC have in this?
The DLC played a central role in lobbying the White House against any kind of consumer-oriented modifications in the telecommunications package, number one. But number two, the key theme for the DLC underlying all of this is to free up any and all public funds for investment in Wall Street, including what now is tied up in utilities, publicly regulated or owned utilities, like in California, including Social Security, which the DLC is pushing to privatize completely.
Clearly, welfare repeal must be the pride and joy of the DLC.
It is, and it's interesting because about a month ago, I was talking to some DLC people in Washington. At that point, they were still very angry at President Clinton. They viewed him as having caved on a number of significant issues in the last couple of years. And now suddenly it's all turned around and, you know, Clinton is the new Democrat again and these people have come into Chicago riding high.
You know, we hear a lot, and we spoke a lot here on Pacifica, the Republican Convention, about the influence of the religious right on the Republican delegates. We don't hear a whisper here of the influence of the DLC on the Democratic delegates.
Well, it's interesting because the DLC right now does not have a lot of delegates. And in fact, I ran into Will Marshall, the head of the Progressive Policy Institute, in the hallway, and he was saying he was feeling great about this convention until he went down on the floor and he found that the delegates are just too liberal for him.
And yet, like the Christian Coalition wrote the GOP platform, the DLC wrote the platform for the Democrats.
Exactly.
It had a profound impact. The religious right question is also very important, though, because the DLC, although it generally emphasized kind of a rightward spin, did not until recently take on the kind of faith and values questions that the religious right has. But Senator Joseph Lieberman from Connecticut, who is an Orthodox Jew and one of the most conservative members of the Democratic Party.
And who President Clinton calls at 1 and 2 in the morning to have long late-night calls.
An old friend of the president is also a business partner, essentially, with former drug czar Bill Bennett.
Right.
On, you know, rock and roll lyrics, on family values, on all of these things.
What's the DLC's position on affirmative action?
The DLC hates affirmative action. The DLC says that you can't have any kind of preferential treatment for minorities. And really, the DLC exists in part to bash affirmative action, to bash unions, to bash liberals. That's one of their favorite sports.
Well, I'm sure Maxine Waters is not one of their prides and joy of the DLC.
Scarcely. She's
and,
a fat noir.
In our next segment, we are going to hear from Maxine Waters speaking yesterday at a symposium of progressive Congress members and other activists. You're listening to Democracy Now! We want to thank Bruce Shapiro, who writes for The Nation magazine, is going to have a piece in an upcoming issue on the DLC and its future plans and ideas, like the privatization of Social Security. Stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Salim Wakil. And yesterday, Salim, we went to this event that happened in the afternoon that was put together by Bob Bourassage of the Center for Policy Studies, the Institute for Policy Studies. And it had a number of people, I guess they could be called the left wing of the Democratic Party in the standard party politics terms, certainly not, I would say, left-wing in general, though Hillary Clinton is very fond of saying there's no left-wing in the administration. And the last person to speak yesterday was Maxine Waters, Democrat from Los Angeles, one of 50 members of the House who are part of the Progressive Caucus, not quite the same progressive that we hear in the Progressive Policy Institute that you were just mentioning. That's the Progressive Policy Institute of the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Conference. Well, she spoke at this event sponsored by the Campaign for America's Future, a group that advocates a shift of national priorities. And in her speech, she discussed her own struggle over the direction of her Democratic Party. And as she spoke, Salim and I looked at each other and he said, we think the listeners should take a listen to this.
I went across the street in Grant Park yesterday, where there were about 300 or 400 young black males at Grant Park under the leadership of some young man they call Gator. And Gator has been running around Illinois, and I've seen him in Washington, D.C., trying to talk with elected officials. And people kind of talk to him, but they shine him on, you know. And you ask about him, and they say, well, you know, he works with, you know, kind of the kids who are in gangs, and he's a good guy. But Gator is not invited into the Democratic Party to participate. We really don't pay much attention to the Gators of the world. And these children in America's cities have literally been dropped off of America's agenda. And so those young people that I went to talk with in Grant Park yesterday, warned not to go, told that I should not be seen over there. Those are the young people that I see as I travel throughout America. I see these young people without jobs, without hope, and I see them increasingly moving to crime, selling one rock cocaine to make a living. And America's response to them is to reject the Sentencing Commission's recommendations about what we do with young people in inner cities who get caught with one rock cocaine. And the Sentencing Commission is telling us, stop filling up the prisons with them. That something is wrong with the nation, that will have mandatory federal sentencing for young, silly folk who get involved in this drug trade when there are people with 100 times more in powdered cocaine who get a slap on the wrist, not targeted by the Justice Department, and the federal prisons are just filling up. The young people who go in those places are dangerous when they come out. But they come out to our cities and our communities with no jobs, no hopes of ever getting a job, felony records, and it gets worse and worse. And so we belong to a party that once really believed that we were the party that was about the belief that everybody deserves to work. Everybody should have a job. We once really believed that. And we should have moved to the leadership of this fight to ensure that there were jobs for Americans. But we have watched the exportation of these jobs, and somehow Nike and others who export our jobs and exploit others offshore or are contributors to our campaigns can set up all of these exhibits, participate with us as if they are credible citizens. I don't know why we tolerate what we tolerate. People talk about angry white males. There are angry white males, angry black males, angry white females, angry white black females. Everybody's angry in America. And the Republicans tell us this set of people should be angry against that set of people. And you know, they've done their message so well. And they have captured the right-wing talk shows and all of these airwaves. And people really believe that some group is the cause of their problems. And so, we have a party that we love. A party that once really stood for something. A party that fought for children. A party that fought for families and the ability to work. Somehow, we have allowed our party to become something that we really don't recognize much anymore. We want to hang on to this party because we know what it has once been. We like the people oftentimes that we elect because they really are good people. But you know what they don't have? They don't have people out there who are willing to organize, who are willing to fight, who are willing to tell them what they'd better do. And so they get away with doing not enough. Yes, yes, we have some brave people, and some of them are sitting right here in this room today. Bonnier really did lead that fight against Newt Gingrich. Bonnier took the floor, and they came after him. You heard the kind of district he comes from. He could be taken out any day, and certainly in this election. How many people will fill his campaign headquarters? How many people will walk precincts? How many people will contribute their dollar? How many people will fill up a phone bank? Somehow, folks believe that politicians who don't hear from them politicians, without being urged and encouraged, are simply going to do what they want them to do. I think it's about time we take back our Democratic Party. I talk about those young people out there a lot because I understand who they are. And when I went to speak to them, I asked them how many really wanted to change their lives. The hands went up. I asked them how many knew about Pell Grants, and I tried to explain it to them and tried to tell them where to go get some help. I asked them how many knew about the three strikes and you're out and the fact that there is no crime prevention but jails waiting to lock them up. That's it. I saw the faces of those young people. They deserve us working for them. And I think we can do that. But in order to do that, we've really got to feel like we have the power to give some direction to this party. Jobs, job creation, our party must lead the way for investment in the infrastructure. We've got to rebuild the bridges. We've got to work with building the sewer systems, repairing the roads. We've got to do the investment in job creation, investment in the infrastructure that will move this country forward. We've got to deal with a tax policy that's been created in this country that allows the rich to get away with not paying their fair share while they take it from the pocket of the workers. I think we can do all of these things. This is the last time I'm going to come to a convention on the heels of a welfare reform bill such as we're confronted with, knowing it is the absolute wrong direction to go in, understanding how it will drive children and families into poverty, understanding the deep and profound change in public policy that has been created here, understanding what it is doing to our elderly, understanding what it is doing to our disabled, and the slap in the face and the foot on the necks of the immigrants that it's causing. It is the last time that I'm going to come to a convention and have to talk about undoing it later. We're in the unfortunate situation where Dole, Gingrich, and Kemp are the worst possible kind of human beings serving as policymakers we could ever encounter. And we have a right to be afraid of what they will do and what they can do. And so we must work to keep them out of office and to get rid of them. The fact of the matter is, we must train and develop organizers who are willing to do real organizing. Dolores Huerta knows what I'm talking about. If we take the work of Bob Borsage and this campaign, the work of organized labor, and the support for elected officials who are willing to stand up, we can win. We can strengthen this Democratic Party. This is my party. I believe in it, and I want to stay in it. But I refuse to be in a party that's moving further and further to the right and not being about the business of the people who make up the base of this party, the people who depend on the leadership of a party that will ensure that human beings can realize their full potential in a country that holds out that promise. I believe that we can do it, and I think that you believe it. So let's get about the business of doing it.
Maxine Waters, Democrat from Los Angeles, speaking to a progressive group of Democrats yesterday and non-Democrats at a a rather strange setting, the opulent Waldorf room of the Conrad of the Chicago Hilton.
Well, I guess that's part of the picture of this Democratic convention. We'll see if Maxine Waters' speech tonight on the floor of the Democratic convention is any different, or of course from the podium, than the speech that she gave here, calling for Gator Bradley, for example, to be included in the Democratic Party. And where is the appeal to inner city youth, and where is the help for people as a result of welfare appeal and other issues?
Right, and she spoke of Gator Bradley, who's been in the struggle for many years trying to transform the kind of cultural inclination of these young people who are being incarcerated in record numbers and coming out of jail with no skills and no way to parlay their power and their youthful energy and whatnot into any kind of political power. And Gator Bradley was one of the people who spoke outside at this Grant Park event,
right. You know, there have been protests all week for listeners who are just getting a chance to watch TV on the floor of the convention. They've been pretty tame, and actually later in the week we're going to be talking with Paul DiRienzo, who's been following all these protests and who is bringing us this sound. But Gator Bradley, maybe it's fair to say, has grown into a figure of near mythic proportion since his conversion from gang leader to an advocate of voter registration and black voter strength. He was followed into Grant Park by hundreds of quiet but determined African-American youth, bussed from throughout the city. He spoke with Pacifica's Paul DiRienzo at the beginning of the news conference that was also attended by California Representative Maxine Waters.
Police commit crime. Okay? My whole thing is, I believe in authority. I believe in the enforcement of law. I'm just saying that police brutality need to be a crime with a mandatory sentence. And maybe police officers will stop beating their wives. You follow what I'm saying? Because it's not a black and white situation. They're brutalizing everybody. And the reason we picked this site is because in 68 is where they beat the protesters at. This is a form of protest. So that means we got a right to play this tape for 2 hours with the cursing, whatever it is. Just show them that to have their rights is important. It ain't no black or white thing. It's Americans having a right. Like the media got a right to print what they want to print. You follow what I'm saying? They can't shut nobody down, you know, because of the threat of national security. But we got a right as a people. If we lose that, we might as well be over in Russia some other way, man.
So what was your name again?
My name is Wallace Gator Bradley.
Are you planning to march anywhere, or are you allowed to stay here?
We're going to stay right here and exert the lottery that I won. We're going to leave from here and have a peaceful march back to the buses, and we're going to leave. You know what I'm saying? They're looking for us to have a confrontation. When about that? Okay, when I speak, it's going to be against police brutality. This is the same site where they beat up the other protesters. You know, just letting them know that they got a right, because they say they're gang members, you ain't locked up, you got a right to vote. You see what I'm saying? They got rights. That's what this whole move is about, rights.
Wallace Gator Bradley, a former gang member and now organizer here in Chicago, speaking yesterday in Grant Park. We are going to be bringing you speeches of people outside the convention, and one of those who spoke yesterday was Daruba Bin Wahad. He is known very well for being in jail for 19 years. He was convicted after 3 trials of attempting to murder 2 police officers. He got out of jail 19 years later when a judge threw out his conviction based on information that came out on counterintelligence, the COINTELPRO program of the government. And he was speaking on this day yesterday that honored political prisoners, especially Leonard Peltier, as well as protesting the death penalty in this country.
We'd like to introduce Daruba Bin Wahad, Former political prisoner, former member of the Black Panther Party.
Power to the people! Power to the people! Power to the people! This is Chicago, 1996, and everyone is acting like they're totally intimidated. And the reason why people are acting like they're intimidated today is because in the United States, we have a new form of democracy. We have a new form of direct democracy. And that form of direct democracy is called democratic fascism.
I said democratic fascism, where you get to vote, but you can't vote for nobody. Where you get to hoop and holler at the Republican or Democratic convention, and then these crackers go on.
DeRuba Bin Wahad will be bringing you more voices outside the convention throughout the week. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer is Michael Yoshida. Production help from Errol Maitland, Janice K. Bryant, and thanks to Paul D'Arienzo. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky and Salim Wakil. If you'd like a copy of today's show, 1-800-735-0230 is the number to call. 1-800-735-0230. Thanks for listening to Democracy Now! From all around the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, this is Democracy Now! Why have working-class Americans lost their loyalty to the Democratic Party? Author Samuel Friedman follows several generations of three American families who moved from Roosevelt to Reagan and beyond. Parties for the Party. The corporate presence is strong here at the convention. We'll take you to an event and find out who's giving how much and why. And a visit to the convention floor with social critic and satirist Michael Moore.
People don't vote not because they're apathetic, but because they've just had it. They've had it with being had. And it's really an incredible form of protest that many people gather together the first Tuesday in November, and without really any kind of organizing amongst themselves, just decide that they're going to refuse to participate in a system that does not respond to their needs.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And welcome to our second hour of Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by our national affairs correspondent Larry Bensky and Salim Wakil, senior editor at In These Times, at also a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times here in Chicago as we broadcast live right next to the United Center. Yes, it is named for United Airlines. And many of, Salim, I see you wearing that shoelace around your neck. Many of the reporters here and delegates are wearing passes that hang from a United Airlines shoelace necklace.
I do even better than that. I hang from a United airliner no matter where I travel.
Well, we should say that coming up tonight on the floor of the convention are going to be the women Democratic senators. We'll be hearing from Senator Barbara Mikulski of Maryland, Senator Carol Mosley Braun of Illinois, Senator Dianne Feinstein, and Barbara Boxer of California, and Senator Patty Murray of Washington. Tomorrow on Democracy Now! We'll be bringing you some of their comments, and we'll be bringing you some of our own comments on these senators. Also, Vice President Al Gore will be speaking, Congressmember Bill Richardson, who just came back from Nigeria following Carol Mosley Braun's trip, and Senator Christopher Dodd, who is chair of the Democratic National Committee.
But before that, we're going to go to a very interesting topic right now, the topic of who votes, who doesn't vote, and why they change their votes in America over the years. And joining us from our station WBAI in New York City, our Pacifica station, is Samuel Friedman, who is now a professor of journalism at Columbia University and author most recently of a book called The Inheritance, How Three Families and America Moved from Roosevelt to Reagan and Beyond. Welcome to Pacifica Radio, Samuel Friedman.
Thanks for having me.
Samuel Friedman, I want to begin by kind of defining who we're talking about here. You mention at the beginning of the book that they're variously referred to as Middle America, the Silent Majority, Joe Sixpack, Reagan Democrats. Who are we talking about here?
We're really talking about the swing voters of the last few elections, among other things. Working class and middle class white ethnics, Catholics primarily, to a lesser extent, Jews, the descendants of the immigrants who came here primarily in that 1880 to 1924 period, and who were the backbone of FDR's coalition, stayed in it really for the next 30 to 40 years, and then began their migration out of it, which ended up giving us the Republican Congress of 94.
I want to ask you a kind of a professional's question, which I think Salim and I as writers also would be interested in, is how out of the millions of people you could have chosen in this country, did you choose Frank Trotta, who's now a Republican election lawyer, Tim Carey, who's a campaign strategist for Republicans, and Leslie Mabee, who's a staff member for Republicans? How'd you find those three families?
Well, those three happened to have been classmates at the State University of New York, and that was where in the mid-70s, during the Watergate years, when it seemed least likely and most futile to have been a young Republican, they were all young Republicans. But more importantly, they all came from very diehard Democratic families and families that not only had voted Democratic, but that had been very active in terms of community organizing work, in terms of, in Leslie's family, a grandfather who was a real machine ward healer of the sort we know about from Chicago. And in Frank Trotta's case, a family that was just steeped in the labor movement. And so, to me, it was easy to find a lot of families that had made this migration. In fact, there were people in my own extended family who had done the same thing. The more difficult part of choosing it, and these are really professional issues that maybe you and Salim will appreciate, were to find people whose families had been really active, politically active as Democrats and now active as Republicans, so there was a story that you could narrate other than how people voted every 4 years. And to find families where there were a lot of living relatives, some letters, things that had come down over 70 or 80 years, so you could tell that story, because these are not entitled people who are going to leave their papers to university library. If you're going to tell this kind of history from the bottom up, it has to be put together almost as an oral historian would work.
These people are the nightmare of the Clintonistas. These are the people who they think, if they stay Republican or increasingly move to Republicanism, the Democrats can never regain a majority. And as a result, the Democrats, as we've been talking about on this program today, have moved themselves substantially to the right,
exactly,
largely to try to regain the allegiance of people like the families that you write about in your book. Can that work? Do the Democrats have a chance? Certainly not perhaps getting back the three people that you write about, because they're Republican Party cadres now.
Right.
But how about their families?
But some of their parents, for instance.
Yeah, sure. Some of their parents. Do the Clintons have a chance?
They do have a chance, because what the Clinton, in a way, is the proudest achievement of the Republican Revolution. The fact that you've got a Democratic president willing to sign a welfare reform bill that contravened his own promise that represented a swing of $65 billion in funding. The fact that you've got a Democratic president who opposed, supported NAFTA, who supports school uniforms, opposes gay marriage, has taken stand after stand. This really a Republican type of stand shows how much the right wing has succeeded in moving the ideological center. And what I think the Democrats can succeed, to the extent that the liberal elements of the party, organized labor, minorities, elements of the left, have nowhere else really to go. I think you heard that in what Maxine Waters was saying in the speech you just played, and you certainly heard it from Jesse Jackson and Mario Cuomo last night. There's nowhere else to go. In a way, it's an interesting mirror image of what the Republicans did with the religious right during their convention, which was to marginalize it, knowing that the religious right has nowhere else to go. Those people aren't going to vote for Bill Clinton, and neither in the Democratic case are minorities or most of organized labor going to vote for Bob Dole and Jack Kemp. So the theory, and Bruce Shapiro was talking about this when he was talking about the Democratic Leadership Council, the theory has always been to basically appropriate enough of the Republican positions to occupy the center, which is really kind of the moderate right.
Samuel Friedman, the conventional wisdom, or at least recent conventional wisdom, is that These Democrats that you talk about made their conversion during the period when the Democratic Party became aligned with the Civil Rights Revolution during the Johnson administration specifically. Did you find anything in your research to corroborate that wisdom?
That was very, very much the case. In one of the families, Frank Trotta's family, had a real vivid example of that. His grandfather was a unionized plumber who was such a Democratic diehard that even in 1968 and 72, particularly 72 with McGovern versus Nixon, he voted for McGovern out of a kind of sentimental loyalty. And yet at the same time, his union was sued for job discrimination in 1967. And that was kind of a catalytic event for the whole family, seeing the grandfather, his union, brought up in court, charged with racial discrimination in moving some of the later generations of that family toward the right. We mentioned Tim Carey before. Tim Carey was someone who went to college at a time where New York State had brought in, interestingly, an affirmative action program, but based on class, not race, but actually widely and incorrectly perceived as a program of racial preference, anyway called the Educational Opportunity Program. And for Tim Carey, that kind of program, the perception that he, as a working-class white, didn't come, and as a war veteran, didn't come in for any kind of comparable preference, was part of what made him react against the Democratic Party. So there's truth there, but another element that I found was really interesting is that people in the Democratic coalition, especially working-class white ethnics, somehow stopped perceiving what they had had to gain from big government, state university systems, the kind of suburban development that was made possible by interstate highways, by VA mortgages, by FHA mortgages, by the GI Bill. And what you have is that in the parents' generation, people who are 70 or 80 or 60 years old now, there's still enough of a firsthand memory of those programs to make them potentially winnable for the Democratic Party. But as you get younger, even though we usually think of younger people as being more liberal, mm-hmm. there's no firsthand memory of what the government did, of what activist government provided to the working class and to the middle class, irrespective of race. And so that's where you see this kind of counteraction. And so it's kind of an amazing collective disjunction of memory.
Well, it's also a disjunction of cause and effect. I mean, young people may not credit the roads that they drive on to the federal government or the college buildings that they're studying in to the federal government. But that's partially because the federal government doesn't blow its own horn about this and has basically discontinued a lot of those programs and is not a vibrant presence in people's lives to some extent, except for the IRS, which Bob Dole wants to abolish. Samuel Friedman is who we're talking to. He's author of The Inheritance, How Three Families and America Moved from Roosevelt to Reagan and Beyond, published by Simon & Schuster. Samuel Friedman, former New York Times reporter, now a professor of journalism at Columbia University. Samuel Friedman, I was struck in reading your book about something that never seems to end, and we're certainly being brought back to it here in Chicago this week, and that is the eternal battles of the 60s, the mm-hmm. culture wars. The people you write about, the three families, the three young people who went to SUNY, are people who rebelled, but in a very different way from the people who rebelled in the 60s. And I think there's a general sense somehow in America, sometimes fostered by people like Newt Gingrich, for example, that the 60s were an all-out rebellion of youth against the culture of the country, and that that subsequently destroyed the fabric of American society. But indeed, what went on then, insofar as it did go on, was not all that deep and widespread, and many people were not touched by it and went in a completely different direction, such as your subjects. Talk about that for a minute.
Right. In fact, there was rebellion and counter-rebellion. And these were people who, as I was saying, I remember from being in college in the mid-70s, it seemed like nothing could be more more out of it, more nerdy than to have been a young Republican at the time Nixon was going down in flames.
But you didn't go to the state. You didn't go to the State University of New York, did you?
No, I went to the University of Wisconsin. You can imagine how we looked at people who were in the Young Republicans out there. I mean, we used to have debates on the college newspaper of were we pro or con the Symbionese Liberation Army. That's about where politics were in Madison. But that's another story. But these were people who partly rebelled against the 60s, primarily around issues of patriotism and social conservatism. Someone like Tim Carey, who was one of four brothers in his family to serve in the military, one enlisted, the other three got drafted. And so the kind of ongoing resentment that he felt against people who either had college deferments or who in other ways didn't serve was something that really fueled his whole political point of view. Or someone like Frank Trotta, who at age 15 was organizing parades in New Rochelle, where he lived, in favor of the boys in Vietnam, or someone like Leslie Mabee, who watched her college roommate get pregnant by a boyfriend and felt this as kind of an affront to her own sense of propriety and kind of took refuge.
She didn't literally watch it.
No, but this was happening right around her. And these were forces, these were events that for all of them led this incredible counter-rebellion against what they saw as the culture of the 60s. At the same time, though, what's interesting is that people on the right really admired and took a lot of the 60s left's rhetoric and a lot of its style.
And Frank a lot Trotta, of its drugs.
Frank Trotta.
And you hear a lot Frank of its Trotta rhetoric went, these days.
Yeah. Well, the whole Frank Trotta went to a summer camp for young Republicans that was like a basically a recruiting organization and training group for the guerrillas, so to speak, of the new right. This was a Republican group that was anti-Rockefeller, anti-Hugh Scott, anti any of the moderate Republicans of that era, and yet they would do things like make up satiric anti-John Lindsay songs to the tune of Yellow Submarine, and Frank made up buttons at one point saying, make love, not laws. So there was a lot of taking the style, the political theater, the uses of rhetoric, and just kind of the energy of anger that was, of social anger that was part of the left in the 60s, and turning it to the completely opposite political end. So it's too simple when Newt Gingrich or people like Collier and Horowitz boil it down as simply 60s versus anti-60s. It's a little bit more complicated and interesting than that.
You also say move from Roosevelt to Reagan and beyond. Where beyond did you look?
Well, the book ends in 94, so it ends with the election of the Republican Congress. But also in these families, some of the older generation had gone back to Clinton. People like Tim Carey's mother who and Leslie Mabee's mother, who had been pretty much lifelong Democrats but had voted for George Bush in 1988, came back to vote for Clinton in 92. And these are kind of the prototypical swing voters who both parties are striving to get this year.
What about the role of race? You write about the Trotta family, for example, and the fact that Frank Trotta ultimately leaves his childhood community of New Rochelle after a racial disturbance there and takes the money he then has and moves to Greenwich, Connecticut, where you're very unlikely to have a racial disturbance of any kind, at least in our lifetimes. Do you think that these people who became what we can call racial Reagan Democrats basically are racist?
No, I don't think so. I've certainly spent enough time around these people that I would never slap a label on them that way. I've heard the term racial conservative used as a distinguishing one, and I think that might be more the way I would describe them, racial conservative, really being more typical of people in the North who supported in a passive kind of way the civil rights movement when it was going against legalized segregation in the South. But once it took on economic issues and housing issues in the North, then they began to oppose it. And the other thing that was paradoxical with these families and complicated is that these were families that tended to live in more proximity to blacks because of what their economic class was than did a lot of the liberals in their communities. For instance, New Rochelle, where Frank was from, was a town that had its own big school desegregation case in the 50s. And during that, in fact, was a case that was cited as precedent later when Judge Garrity ordered the busing program in Boston. And in New Rochelle, the schools that were the most segregated were in the most liberal, affluent sections of town. The handful of schools that were the most integrated happened to be in the working-class Italian section, which bordered the working-class black section. So you have really wheels within wheels of race here, personal affinity and yet political opposition coexisting.
Yeah, and that those wheels within wheels are very well spun by you in this book, Samuel Friedman, The Inheritance, How Three Families in America Moved from Roosevelt to Reagan and Beyond. We have just about 60 seconds left. Can you tell us what you think the Democrats have to do in a formula, if I was going to hire you as a political consultant, to win back the loyalties of these people and to win their children's loyalties of the young people now coming up in these families?
They're already doing it. What they have to do is become virtual Republicans. And as a liberal myself, I'm sad to say that that is what the Democratic Party is doing. passing the welfare, signing the welfare reform bill that Clinton signed. I guess his bone that he's going to throw on Thursday night is to use tax credits to try to stimulate jobs. I mean, that's a plan that would come really right out of supply-side economics, to use tax policy rather than Keynesian economics to try to create jobs. He's already done this, the kind of public humiliation that he subjected Jesse Jackson to with the Sister Soldier episode in 1992, the show of, quote, standing up to, quote, unquote, black militants. Those pieces of political theater are all geared to getting back this working class vote, and clearly they thought that they could get it with a middle class entitlement like health insurance, and when that didn't work, they've even trimmed their sails there. So what Clinton's doing is making himself an Eisenhower or a Nixon, and that's winning back the center so far.
And you said, sad to say, but tactically, it's probably the best way to get back.
Well, if your only goal is winning, if you have no principles, right, you don't care what it is that you do, then of course it's a tactic you can take.
Exactly. The question is what you're going to be left with at the core after you've taken this. I mean, the Democrats may win the election, but the Republicans have won the ideological war, and that's where we're left as a country now. Again, I have no stake in saying that. I'm not a conservative Republican. I feel marginalized individually in a country by where it's gone, but as you read the history, you have to say that the right has won the ideological war, and Clinton's proof of it.
Well, we'll try not to marginalize you on Pacifica, Samuel Friedman.
Thank you.
Professor of Journalism at Columbia University, thank you for joining us today on Democracy Now! I'm Larry Bensky with Salim Muakil. Amy Goodman rejoins us in a moment. We'll be back to talk about campaign finance in 60 seconds.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, the program that dares to ask the questions the corporate media won't. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky and Salim Wakil. Now, Larry,
what's that in your lap,
Salim,
Amy?
If you can just help me out here. I want to ask you two guys what all of this has in common. I got this goodie bag. I you could say I absconded with it yesterday at one of the corporate parties. What are you holding in your hand, Salim?
I'm holding a all fruit.
Palander all fruit?
That I will not call jelly.
I'm Larry. Holding a container of Robitussin.
I've got with me FiberCon and Advil. Would you like the FiberCon, Salim?
I'll take the Advil. I think I need it.
Centrum.
What are DimeTap 12-hour extension? Oh, these are the cold medicine.
Caltrate. Okay. I can use this.
Caltrate.
This is lovely.
Centrum. Let's see. Dristan.
Here's something that makes good radio. Crunch and Munch. Buttery toffee popcorn with peanuts.
Yeah,
well, what is buttery toffee popcorn with peanuts have to do with baby Ambersol teething pain? Do you know what all of these things have to do with each other?
They're all
Chapstick.
Sold in stores.
This is true. And Robitussin and Dristan Cold. Not only are they sold in stores, but they're sold by the same corporation.
Uh-huh.
And that corporation is, as we see on this little goodie bag on the outside, goodie box, I should say, is Wyeth Arist. And yes, I got a chance to go to a party sponsored by Wyeth Arist and its parent company, American Home Products, yesterday. It was at the Chicago Arts Center, and it was put on to honor the Democratic congresswomen who had come to this Democratic convention. So I was able to get in because I did have an invitation, unlike many of the parties I've been trying to crash at the Democratic and Republican convention. I got in and had a chance to see the congresswomen, all sorts of congresswomen there. There was Rose DeLauro from Connecticut, Nita Lowey and Carolyn Maloney from New York, and Eleanor Holmes Norton from Washington, D.C. After they spoke about what it means to take back the Congress, I was wondering if they're talking about taking it back from the Republicans or the corporations, clearly not the corporations, I had a chance to talk with California Democrat Lynn Woolsey. 120 million people don't vote in this country. That's equivalent to the whole voting age population in 42 states, except for the eight largest. What many people say is the reason for this is not apathy, but anger, frustration, feeling that politicians don't represent them. Now, I'm here looking at money in politics, and I've been going from event to event where corporations are sponsoring the events. This is sponsored by American Home Products and Wyeth Earst. And I wanted to get your feeling about that. I mean, here, the American Home Products is here to, you know, meet with you and to get your ear. Regular citizens can't afford to throw parties like that, these for their politicians. What's your response?
Well, in one way regular citizens do is when workers like labor have their labor PACs and they donate $5 a month possibly to their PAC, and then they contribute to candidates like myself because I fall on my sword every day for labor and for workers across this country, whether or not they're in unions. And so in some ways they do have our ear. What I really have to say, unless we have public financing for our elections and make these elections much shorter and have free media, we're going to be stuck with what we have, and we have to really work on this.
Why do you think President Clinton is not for campaign finance reform in any real way? I mean, he has not pushed anything forward, no matter what he says.
Well, because I can tell you why where my struggle is with it. I'm not going to speak for the president, but until we can assure through the courts that we can put a cap on how much an individual can spend of their own money, then all we'll do is have those who don't have very much money at a disadvantage over below those who are privately financed through their own income. And we'll have a representation across this country of people who are multimillionaires. I mean, that doesn't represent the majority of people in the United States of America.
Last question. That is, Wyeth Earst isn't getting a lot of great publicity these days because of Norplant and the lawsuits against it for women being able to take Norplant out of their arms and the health problems that ensue from that, not to mention the drug itself within Norplant or the hormone itself. What do you say to those women who are out there suffering as people are here being feted by a corporation like American Home Products?
Well, I say Norplant has to step up to their responsibility. Just because I came here and spoke at a podium and then encouraged women to go out and vote doesn't mean that I support Norplant's problems with their products.
Well, I thank you very much for taking. And after I spoke with Lynn Woolsey, I thought things were going pretty well at the party. I was eating, I was talking to people, until a representative from Wyeth Earst came over and said I had to leave.
I had a request from the women who hosted this. They did not want press here.
Uh-huh. I got a formal invitation to come, yeah.
Okay, because they requested now. I mean, that you've basically gotten around to most people, right? Because they've really asked if you can leave.
I don't think so. I think I'll be staying. I mean, if this is politicians, these are elected Congress members. I got an invitation to come here. I didn't know about this except for the invitation we got at the office. What's to hide?
No, there is nothing to hide. I think it's the atmosphere in here. And I'm just asking you, as an event coordinator, I don't want to have to go against security.
Okay. Well, I hope you don't. But I'm covering this event, and I don't think I'm doing anything wrong. Okay.
I mean, it's not like you're harassing anyone.
Right.
I understand that.
Well, I spotted the spokesperson for Wyeth Earst, another official spokesperson. I thought I better get to her before security got to me. How many events is American Home Products sponsoring at the Democratic Convention?
You know, I really don't know.
More than this one?
I believe that we're co-sponsoring with some other companies, some other events, but I'm not certain of that.
Could I ask in general what Wyeth Earst has to gain from sponsoring these events?
To gain? We have nothing to gain. We're celebrating women's health and the contribution, if you'll read the names, of the Democratic women of the House of Representatives.
Do you do the same at the Republican Convention?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. As do other companies.
Well, then, because you're celebrating women's health, I did want to get into the issue of Norplant, because that's such a controversial issue.
Why is that? I'm sorry, you're with who?
I'm with Pacifica Radio.
I guess I don't know Pacifica Radio.
Yeah, it's public radio in the United States.
Where are you?
Around the country. We do a national show. This is a national daily
sure,
election show.
Sure.
And so we're looking at the, you know, we were at the Republican convention, we're here at the Democratic convention, and we're covering.
Perhaps you need to find some new news, but go ahead and ask me on NorPlant if you'd like.
Well, the NorPlant issue, since you're concerned about women's health,
yes.
what Wyeth Earst is doing about the issue of women not being able to remove it from their arms and the lawsuits involved with that?
Well, as you can likely expect, any issue that's under litigation we don't comment on. But I can tell you that the company stands firmly behind the safety and efficacy of long-term contraception as it relates to NorPlant. It is as safe and effective today as it was 5 years ago. Is that clear?
Then why are so many women suffering with not being able to get the product out of their arms?
I don't believe your figures are right. I don't believe there are a long-suffering number of women who can't get it out of their arm, and I suspect you need to talk, as you apparently have, to the plaintiff's bar.
Now, security, I was afraid, was getting a little too close for comfort, so I ran over to the New York delegates that I recognized from my home state, to State Senator Franz Leichter. Now, he's well known for challenging issues of corporate welfare. I was a little surprised to see him at the party, but I thought better stand next to him than be dragged out. Now, I'm here today because I'm looking at the issue of money in politics, and I've been going to a number of the events sponsored by various corporations. Today, it's American Home Products and Wyeth Earst.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you both how you feel about corporate money in politics and about people's cynicism and anger that they feel they don't have access to their politicians, particularly at the national level, in a way that these corporations do. All they have to do is throw a party like this.
Well, I think it's true. I don't think it's a healthy aspect of American politics, the degree to which money plays a role in the election and also in gaining access to legislators and doing things for legislators. While it may not be called buying votes, certainly is buying access and buying influence. And that's clearly what the corporations are doing here in Chicago. And as you noted, many of the events are sponsored by corporations. I mean, if Councilman Michaels, who's here with me, and I didn't go to any event that was sponsored by a corporation, we'd be spending all our time sitting on a park bench in Grant Park.
Well, if that's what it would come to, why not? You'd see a lot of the protesters and hear what they have to say rather than the corporate lobbyists who are here.
Well, I must say, I haven't seen many protesters around, to be truthful. But it is important for us to meet. For instance, this is an event for the Democratic women in the Congress. I'm very supportive of getting more women into the Congress. So I think it's important that I'm here, and it's important that I support it and network with them and work together with them.
You think it would be better to have publicly funded events at these conventions and not corporate-sponsored events?
Well, I think that you can have events, just as an event that I went to for Emily's List, which was a fundraiser where the delegates paid. Maybe if we had a little less crab meat and other goodies, it would be generally more affordable. But I think the sort of culture has developed, and it's probably not healthy, but in some respect, it's almost so widespread that in some respects it isn't even that meaningful anymore.
Now, as I was talking to New York State Senator Franz Leichter, I was listening to the music in the background, which was the jazz combo that was playing. It was live music. And I noticed that what they were playing was, well, actually quite appropriate. It was that old Beatles song, I get By With a Little Help from My Friends. And you're listening to Democracy Now! As we go from that party for the party, we're here in the studio with Larry Bensky and Salim Wakil. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is Ellen Miller, head of the Center for Responsive Politics, who's been looking at the money in the Democratic and Republican Party conventions.
Yeah, but first, did you get kicked out of that party or did you stay till the end?
They got a little nervous as the legislators seemed to know who I was and as I started to interview them. But they were very angry, and every time I came up to them, they asked me to leave.
Hmm. I bet you didn't give back the goodie bag. I see you brought it to us.
Yes, I brought it to you.
Ellen, would you like to have it? Should we bring it back to Washington for you?
I think most of those products are probably handed out on Capitol Hill every day.
For me,
it's really not. Yeah, it's really not the. It's not the goodie bag. I mean, that really is. The small change of what's going on. But I think a lot of the folks that Amy talked with really tell it better than any quote unquote expert like myself can tell it.
One thing an expert like you can tell us is how much money you think the Democrats are going to raise here globally this week at this convention for all of their various little pockets that they stuff it into.
You know, it's hard to estimate. We know that in the last election cycle in 1994, $724 million was raised and spent on elections. What percentage of that this time will be raised around the conventions is almost impossible to estimate. We could probably look back. But I think, you know, the very notion that conventions are fundraising opportunities or access buying opportunities, it's really counter to the notion of I think what political conventions used to be all about.
Well, you heard,
which
Senator,
is the celebration of the candidates.
Well, or the discussion of politics. Heaven forbid we should have that. You heard Senator Leichter just say that if he didn't have parties to go to, he'd have to be sitting on a bench in Grant Park, and I think that goes a long way towards.
Or more if he had to go to a party that wasn't sponsored by a corporation.
He was sitting on a bench in Grant Park. I mean, heaven forbid that they should discuss the pressing socio-political issues of our time at a political convention.
I think Amy's interviews were right on, and she, in their most candid moments. Most lawmakers, no matter, where they serve, what level of government they serve, will tell it like it is. You know, money buys access. We don't much like the system, but it is the system. And not many of them will lend their weight to changing it.
Well, you sent us a long fax yesterday saying that more than 70 businesses and unions gave $100,000 donations to Chicago 96, the host convention, the host committee for this convention. There's an article today in the National Journal Convention Daily saying that 400 of the most elite donors went on a yacht yesterday. They contribute at least $50,000 a year to the party's funds for the Democratic National Committee. This is just totally out of control, this stuff.
Yeah, it is absolutely out of control. I mean, it is an absolute corporatization of our politics. And frankly, it doesn't matter whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, many of the same donors. But when you really are talking about, one of the folks that Amy talked about, it sort of all balances itself out. It doesn't balance itself out. I mean, there are maybe pharmaceutical companies and insurance companies and energy companies and agribusiness and communications companies, but nowhere represented in the corporate elite are the voices of the people. I mean, there is no balance. There's no balance here. Again, one of Amy's interviews mentioned, labor, people give through their PACs. Labor PACs are outspent by a factor of 7-1 by corporate America across the board, and that's for congressional campaigns. There's no balance here. People's voices are not represented. And this money is not given out of love of democracy or because the corporations want to have a great party in San Diego or in Chicago. It's because they want something in Washington. Every one of these corporations has some kind of Washington-based regulatory, subsidy-oriented legislative agenda.
Ellen Miller, can you name some of those corporations that are most deeply involved in the effort?
Sure. In terms of the funding, for the convention, both conventions have their $100,000 givers. For the Democrats, I mean, we're looking at pharmaceutical companies like Abbott Labs, insurance companies like Allstate Insurance, deeply interested in Superfund reform, energy companies like Amoco, all, again, interested very much in environmental issues, agribusiness, ADM, interested in, ethanol and various subsidies, as well as a price-fixing case ongoing at Justice. Communications companies like AT&T, who've turned their attention from Congress to the regulatory side of things as the new regulations are developed to implement the new communication statute. Banks like Bank America, very much interested in banking reform proposals. I mean, this is, a who's who when you're looking at these corporations funding the Democrats that do not have the Democratic constituency at heart. They have their own economic bottom lines at heart.
I should say American Home Products, which owns Wyeth Earst, was particularly interested in the Women's Health Equity Act of 1996. And I was speaking to the head of some of the state legislative organizations that help women speak to each other, learn how to speak, et cetera, be public speakers. And they said that most of their events are sponsored by companies like Wyeth Earst as they train women to become legislators.
Yeah, I think that there's no question that, that sponsoring, meetings, conferences, which arguably inform legislators is, has its useful side, but more important than what people may learn at these kinds of meetings is the kind of a quid pro quo that results, the telephone call that gets returned. I was amused in the New York Times this morning. Francis Klein's had a great piece called Poobah's Princes High Above the Hoi Polloi. And, you know, in the skyboxes, which no doubt you folks have observed in Chicago.
We tried to get into it.
We've observed them from afar, I assure you.
Yes, that's right. I'd love to hear more audio from that. But there's a quote in this story this morning, you know, from James Carville, you know, the sort of now ousted or on the fringes political consultant from 92, in which he says, you know, very candidly, money makes a difference. You know, when the contributors call, we take those calls every time. Apparently, at least according to the story, the delegates are beginning to consider, you know, one of the basic premises that is apparently too obvious.
One of the hardest things about this is if you look at these products that Amy brought back in the goodie bag,
take those, Larry.
And I'm just looking at them. I'll take the Advil one by one.
No, I'm going to take the Advil after the election's over.
Maybe you'll need it before then. You look at who makes these things, and it doesn't say anywhere that this company, Wyeth Erst, is the one. One is supposedly manufactured by A.H. Robbins, the other by Whitehall Laboratories, the other American Home Products. In other words, their corporate conglomerate ownership is disguised in their labeling even. So if a person wanted to act against these corporations and figured out a way to do it, you'd have a hell of a time even figuring out who they were.
Yeah, what we do when we try to follow the money is we try to affiliate all of these individual corporate subsidiaries of these major holding companies. And so we can look at the true clout of their money by saying, well, it's not just a contribution from X company or Y company, but this is really all one company with one agenda,
Ellen,
or perhaps they have several agendas.
Ellen Miller, we want to thank you very much for joining us for this brief time this morning. Ellen Miller is director of the Center for Responsive Politics. You can call them by email at info@crp.org. Their phone number, 202-857-0044. That's 202-857-0044. And I should say that the New York delegation is not allowing any parties to be sponsored by the tobacco companies. That's where they have drawn the limit. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds with Michael Moore. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Michael Moore flew into Chicago the other day on Monday night, the first night of the convention, and armed with my pass, my floor pass, and one for Michael, we made our way into the United Convention Center.
This was very easy getting in here. Too easy. You and I are two people they should not have allowed in here. The security here is pathetic.
Oh, there we go. We're getting checked again. You're going to touch us?
Yes, yes.
All right.
Thank you.
Touch me right there.
There we go.
Thank you.
I can't believe we're actually here.
Hey,
where are you from?
Cincinnati.
Cincinnati.
Yes.
Homer Procter & Gamble.
Oh, yeah. We met you on Fountain Square down there.
Oh, when
yeah,
the chicken?
When you were in town.
Oh, when
yeah.
I came.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Wow,
that was great. With the chicken, yeah.
Yeah, crackers. Yeah.
And then they took you off the air.
Well, you know, you give it your best shot, right?
Yeah.
And then you come back.
Yeah. Oh, you're coming back.
Yeah, I think we'll be back on next year, so it's looking pretty good.
Fantastic.
Yeah. What did you do with the chicken?
The chicken went there to find out what the corporate crimes were in Cincinnati.
And he found a lot of them, and the next thing we knew, they took him off the air.
Yeah. The chicken
didn't get to report on
it. He never got to report on that great welfare recipient, Procter & Gamble, you know? But, you know, I heard that that Congress,
by the way, Michael Moore produced the most successful movie documentary in history. It's called Roger and Me, and he has a new book out called Downsize This.
Yeah. Oh, wrong kind of welfare, huh?
Wrong welfare.
Wrong kind of welfare. Oh, well.
Michael, what about that number of people who don't vote in this country? I think your book is like one of the first times I've seen it written.
Yeah. People don't vote, not because they're apathetic, but because they've just had it. They've had it with being had. And it's really an incredible form of protest that many people gather together the first Tuesday in November, and without really any kind of organizing amongst themselves, just decide that they're going to refuse to participate in a system that does not respond to their needs. The equivalent of the voting age population of 42 states does not vote. Only 8 states, the 8 largest states, vote, if you took that number and made it an equivalent number.
I think they're applauding you.
No, I think the movie star is finishing. Oh, no, wait. It must be prime time. Check your watch right now. See, all the TV lights just came on. Am I right?
Have you been to any of the parties here? The other night I went over to Scoozie's, which is a restaurant, and Philip Morris was having a party for the Kentucky and Virginia delegations. They wouldn't let any journalists in, at least journalists from out of state.
I've been to nothing but parties here. And, you know, because, you know me, I'm just a party kind of guy. You know, Amy actually does know me and knows I've never been to a party in my life. But actually, I'm glad you brought this up. These are the people who are sponsoring the convention here. Thanks to their generous contributions of a minimum of $100,000 each to the Democratic Party. These are tonight's sponsors: Allstate Insurance, Amoco, Sears and Roebuck, Ameritech, Quaker Oats, McDonald's, United Airlines, AT&T, Sara Lee, need I go on?
Yes. Did you say United?
United Airlines.
Did you notice that everyone has a pass around their neck and they've got a United Airlines shoestring that is keeping it around their neck?
Well, now, Amy, you know they're an employee-owned company. Wink, wink. Actually, it's my hope within about 2 hours to lead all of these Democrats out of here and into that protest pen that they've set up across the street.
I don't think they fit and no one would hear them.
I'll get them all in there. I'll get them.
My wife to take a picture.
Oh, yes,
you and
yes,
me.
Sir. Here we go, right here.
There's been all this talk about Republicans trying to sound like Democrats, Democrats trying to sound like Republicans. That's led a lot of people to say there's not much difference between the parties.
There isn't. It's I call it the evil of two lessers, you know, or the choice between Tweedledum and Tweedledummer, you know, stuffing or potatoes, Hitler or Mussolini. Well, I guess Mussolini was better, wasn't he? Whoa! I mean, what does that mean? You know, it's like, I don't know. You know, not that I'm not, of course, comparing them to those two dictators of ill repute.
Who do you think the majority of the voting age population, the ones that aren't voting, who do you think they're angriest at?
Actually, you know, this is why Bob Dole has a very good chance of winning. I think people are going to be angriest at the Democrats because they've turned their back on the working and non-working people of this country. And those people just aren't going to bother to vote on Election Day. And the Republicans, they always come out, no matter what's going on. Floods, hurricanes, riots, they'll be there to vote for Bob Dole. You know, there's just that Mooney-like thing that goes on with the Republicans. So that's how Dole can win. That's how he'll pull this off, because Clinton has turned his back on the people who are his natural base, and they will not be motivated to come out and vote for him.
Do you see differences between Dole and Clinton?
I see very few differences, you know. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, which is the worst movie, Happy Gilmore or the Brady Bunch sequel? I mean, we could debate that all night. It's about as insignificant a discussion as Dole and Clinton.
But there are those who are disappointed with Clinton who would say that he is certainly a shield against Gingrich at all.
That's the big lie, as far as I'm concerned. I think that if we fall for that, let me put it this way. Clinton, for the better part of the summer, has been 20 points ahead in the polls. What better time to stand up for the Republicans and say, no, I'm not going to sign this welfare bill? He's stronger now than he's ever been. If he wasn't willing to stand up to Newt and Dole when he was 20 points ahead, what's he going to do 2 years from now when he isn't going to be 20 points ahead? You know, he's going to be singing their tune even more. So I don't buy that theory at all.
What could happen at this convention? Is there anything you could envision happening at this convention that would give you a reason to have hope in this party?
Yes. That if all the delegates here just sort of stood up, apologized to the American people, and walked out, Maybe they could all go lock themselves in that protest pen across the street.
You know, Bill Clinton said that if you don't like the welfare bill, that's why you should vote for me. That's what all the Congress members who are supporting him are saying, that if you don't like this bill that he signed, that's why you should vote for the Democrats.
Right. So let me get that straight now. If you don't like the bill that I signed, vote for me, because then when I get back in, I'm going to unsign it. I mean, you know, I really think the American people are pretty smart. I don't think they're stupid. And I think that's why the majority, unfortunately, are going to stay home, you know, because they don't have a choice at the polls.
Are you going to vote?
You know, I don't know what I'm going to do. Right now, I'm a non-voter. Right now, I'm in the camp of the 120 million people who don't have really any place to go. I'm in the majority. This is a show for the minority. What's going on here in San Diego?
Well, what does it feel like to be on the floor right now?
I have never done, you know, I've sneaked into many Democratic conventions and a couple of Republican ones, but I've never been down on the floor. And I can't believe, you know, that it was left-wing radical radio that brought me here.
Michael, you're so busy criticizing corporations, yet it's corporations that have brought your face to millions of Americans.
Well, this is the extreme irony, isn't it? And I think it's one of the funniest things about the show, the fact that every 10 minutes after we slam corporate America, there's a commercial for McDonald's, you know, or some other company. And it's like, wow, you know. I guess they probably don't perceive the show as much of a threat, so the more they keep thinking that way, the longer I'll be able to stay on. You know, when the day actually comes that, you know, they think, oh, this is bad for us, we'll be off.
What are you trying to accomplish with your show, TV Nation, and also with your new book, Downsize This?
Well, I think we need voices in the media that represent the average working or non-working person in this country. And it's really rare that somebody from Flint, Michigan would be allowed on network television to have his say. I mean, it's just, when we were growing up in Flint, you know, we would never see that. We'd never hear our voice. You know, we'd see caricatures of ourselves as, you know, shop rats or whatever. But, you know, we never really see ourselves on television. And so to have that opportunity, you know, I mean, I feel, you know, pretty lucky to have that. And I hope I get to continue.
The beginning of your book, you have two photographs.
Yeah.
One of the Oklahoma City building. Yeah. What's the other photograph, and what are you trying to say?
There are two photographs here side by side at the beginning of the book. One is the federal building in Oklahoma City, and one is the old Chevrolet factory in Flint, Michigan, under the heading of What is Terrorism? You know, obviously, the first one's terrorism. 168 people died. But what do we call it when a corporation removes the people first from the building, then blow it up? But then over the next few years, many of those people die through suicide, spousal abuse, drugs, alcohol. Isn't that a form of terrorism? Isn't that wrong? Isn't that immoral? You know? And when are we going to put on trial the Timothy McVeighs of corporate America? When will we see that day?
You know, on the pier on Saturday night, there was a big party for the delegates and the 15,000 press.
Yeah.
There was a display of Chevrolet there. They had a big exhibit.
Yeah, well, I believe the UAW party, the union party here, is co-sponsored by Chrysler. You know, what I mean, my uncle, who helped to found that union by sitting in the factory for 44 days, would be, you know, spinning in his grave right now if he knew this was going on. He probably does know what's going on, and he's spinning as we speak.
I'm a member of Congress from Ohio.
Yes, he is.
I just saw about 6 months ago a tape of your Gingrich TV Nation thing. And I showed that to a whole bunch of members of the House. It is so great.
Now, you are congressman from where?
From Northeast Ohio.
Northeast Ohio.
What's your name?
Sherrod Brown. And I showed your thing on Gingrich where you said, get off your federally funded lake and all of that. That was so great. How'd you get that? Did Gingrich not know who you were when he was interviewing you?
When I first walked up to him, he leaned over to me and said, Mike, there's sharpshooters on the roof. And I looked up and there they were. Now, you voted against that welfare bill, didn't you?
I voted against the welfare bill.
Oh, congratulations.
All right, thank you.
Good job.
The president kind of missed on it, but, you know.
You did a courageous thing.
Thanks.
So are you going to be voting for Clinton in November?
Sure.
I'm Amy Goodman from Pacifica Radio.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure I'm going to vote for Clinton in November. I have disagreements with him, but the race is against Dole and Gingrich and the extremist policies. And the Dole economic plan is going right after Medicare and Social Security. You can't cut taxes on the rich, increase military spending without going right after those programs that matter to working people and to the poor and to the middle class.
What do you think of what Michael was saying, 120 million Americans not voting now? 120 million Americans, equivalent to the voting age population of 42 states.
It's clearly a problem, and I think that Democrats need to adopt better trade policies, better policies to build the middle class and middle class wages.
Are you against NAFTA?
What's that?
Did you vote against NAFTA?
Yeah, I was real involved in that, yeah.
There you go. Thanks.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Michael, what do you think of these people holding signs that say 10 million new jobs? The whole North Carolina delegation.
10 million new jobs at McDonald's and Taco Bell. Boy, I don't know if that's something to brag about.
Michael, can I get a shot with you with my congressman here?
Yes, sir.
That would make me very happy to know that he did.
Wait, there's an important moment happening here.
I want to join your militia.
Mike's militia? Thank you very much. How have you heard about this?
I read it in George.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay. And you meet all the qualifications?
Oh, hell.
You're either a man or a woman, right?
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
All right. Can you name more CEOs than the cast of characters on
Bill
Friends?
Bill Gates, and then...
You got to be able to name 7 CEOs.
Uh-oh.
Stand aside, soldier.
Oh. I feel like a failure.
Nice to meet you can join. Thank you very much. Thank
Do you see the video now? Because it's all made for television, there's a video introducing each speaker.
Oh, wow.
Richard Gephardt.
Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Gephardt!
Hey, all I want to know is, where are the slot machines? It's like Vegas in here.
So, Michael, talk a little more about your book. Let's talk about how you start off the book. Aside from the pictures and terrorism, you've got this memo about how that instructs supervisors how to fire their employees.
Right. This is compiled from actual memos that corporations put out when they so-called downsize. And it's like the etiquette of how to properly do it. You know, have a glass of water available, have Kleenex available, you know, try to have them look on the bright side, and give them the number for ride or truck. You know,
can you read a few of the lines from the memo?
Yes,
where did you get these memos? It's sort of a composite memo?
Yes, it's compiled from Chemical Bank, the Times Mirror Company, and other corporations. Number one, the termination meeting should last no more than 5 to 10 minutes. Two, the termination meeting should be held in a neutral location. Three, avoid small talk. Four, the downsized employee should clearly understand that he or she is being fired and that this will be his or her last day. Five, have Kleenex available. Six, be supportive, but not compromising. Seven, don't be defensive. Eight, don't provide extensive justification for the downsizing. And it goes on like that.
What did you think as you gather these memos?
Well, you know, it's kind of how I look at a lot of this stuff, you know. I get pretty angry at what's going on, and then... you know, my sense of humor hopefully will kick in at some point before I do any serious damage.
So what do you think the answer is?
The answer to what?
The answer to the direction American politics has gone. I mean, right now at this Democratic convention, you have the protest pen outside. You have a bunch of protesters, but there's nothing super organized here. There's nothing that in any way is threatening to the Democratic Party.
It is one of the most astounding things, actually, that... I still haven't quite figured out why millions of Americans don't rise up and demand their government back. I mean, it will happen. I only hope that it will happen in a way that takes into account, you know, the progressive politics that, you know, Pacifica and others have. Unfortunately, the right and the militias... are a very appealing group to people who are hurting, and they know how to manipulate them with fear and blaming and et cetera, et cetera. So,
what about this militia that you're forming?
Mike's militia is for people who are feeling left out of the militia movement and who are firearm challenged. There are no guns in our militia. Basically, I want people to get active, get involved, and you know, at first I thought, you know, we should start a third party. And then I started thinking, wait a minute, we don't even have two parties. How can we talk about a third party?
I just signed my credential for my college professor, Dr. Orr.
What are you doing here?
I work for Kathy Vick, secretary of the DNC. She's the one that does the roll call.
Michael's whole approach is very anti-corporate, and this the Democratic National Convention is really a corporate extravaganza.
Absolutely, yeah, I agree. But, you know, it's, what's the alternative?
You and me. You and me, Incorporated, the people.
Give her a better grade. I love that. Thank you very much.
All right. Do some good work, okay?
Michael Moore, the director of Roger and Me, the largest grossing documentary film of all time. He's also the creator and host of TV Nation, which won an Emmy. And folks, it may be coming back next year. Fox may be carrying it. He also made the films Canadian Bacon, Pets Are Meat, The Return to Flint, Michigan, and was the editor of the Flint Voice for 10 years. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'd love your comments at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer has been Michael Yoshida. Thanks very much to Errol Maitland, Janice K. Bryant, and Paul DiRienzo for their help. With Larry Bensky and Salim Wakil, I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Live from Chicago.